Yeah, it's tragic. It's tragic. And the saddest thing was that I was a bit gagged. We were all a bit gagged. I couldn't speak to the students. I couldn't really email anyone and explain. I couldn't say sorry to the students that I'd taken halfway through a journey and that were fully intending me to carry on to the end of their journey. I wasn't able to be respectful to them. And I that was really hard. That was really hard.
Hello, and welcome to the history of actor training in the British Drama School. This week, I'm delighted to have as my guest Elizabeth Ballinger, Lizzie Ballinger. Lizzie's a friend and a colleague and an extraordinary movement teacher who works in the tradition, the lineage of Trish Arnold. So sit back and enjoy. This one's quite a long podcast. I'm putting this one out as a single, a long single. So maybe if you think it's a bad idea, let me know. But anyway, here we go. A conversation with Elizabeth Ballinger. Enjoy. Anyway, let's go on a more enjoyable journey. So you just mentioned it's been a 20-year journey for you to understand or assimilate the work, to have it. So yeah. could you take us back? I think we've actually introduced you. So, hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. This week, I'm talking to Elizabeth Ballinger, Lizzie Ballinger. Lizzie's been a colleague of mine for a long time. When did we first meet? I remember having
probably at RADA.
Glass of wine with you. At RADA, yeah.
Yeah, probably 2000 and I think I joined there on a sort of placement in 2008.
Yeah,
sometime around there.
Yeah.
You were quite terrifying when I first got there.
I was terrifying. I find
yeah.
No. I don't believe that at all.
Oh, yeah.
And then we were colleagues at Lambda from a year later, a couple of years later. I can't actually remember.
Yeah, about 2012. I think I started at Lambda. Yeah.
Great. Good. And so how did you, let's start then, should we start at the beginning and go forwards or should we start at, why don't we start for the crack? Why don't we start with you at RADA? So 2012, you joined that institution. Where had you been before that? We'll go backwards. I've never done that before.
2012, I started at Lambda. So 2006 to 2008, I was doing my MA at Guildhall. So MA in movement training for actors. So it was after, just on the back of that I started at RADA, which was, yeah, sort of ridiculous and incredibly lucky to walk into that job straight after graduating. So that was the training at Guildhall. We were the first year of cohorts. It was a new MA that Patsy had set up and Wendy Allnut, who was head of movement at the time. Mm. And I was... In fact, I'd applied for the voice. I'm really keen to do voice. Yeah. And in the audition, I was desperately trying to impress Patsy. And Wendy kept asking me questions about my background. You know, obviously I'd put in a CV and things about, like I used to do dressage and I did Thai boxing and lots of physical things. And she just kept sort of probing me, and I was like, no, I want to talk to Patsy about the voice. And they basically phoned up after the interview and said, yeah, we don't think you should do voice. We think you should do movement. And I was a bit like, oh, all right then. Why not?
Yeah.
Don't really know what it is.
Well, I had no idea about that. So you were an actor. Amazing. I mean, that's the way life works, isn't it? Often.
Yeah.
So you were an actor at that point?
Yeah, I was an actor, so I trained at Manchester Met in the late 90s. Gosh, can't even remember. Did the 3-year course, and it was, I guess I didn't really know what movement was because it was all so integrated. The training at Man Met was so, like you just moved all the time. There was Alexander in work in everything. There was sort of voice work in everything. And it felt, I mean, maybe that student's experience now, maybe it's the same for students now, I don't know, but it sort of just flowed. I mean, I think there were things that were lacking as an actor training, like the real specificity and detail. And even my voice teacher at the time said that there wasn't enough sort of precision in the training. But the fact that movement and voice and Alexander work and then into acting just all blurred, sort of moved quite beautifully. When I ended up being offered this place at Guildhall, I was a bit like, oh, I'm not really sure what movement is. Like, how do you train to be, what is it? Mm. Like, why would you, I don't really remember movement classes. I mean, I do remember things like five rhythms, which I remember getting very fed up at movement classes or whatever sort of dancey things or contact improvisations we were doing. I loved it and hated it at drama school. So it was interesting, yeah, when they said be a movement person.
That's amazing. And when you said precision, what do you mean by that precisely? Just, I'm fascinated.
I think it's a sort of structure of a training. I think it didn't quite have enough structure. Like I vaguely remember doing some sort of dialect work, but it just really briefly touched on it. Trish Bailey was my voice person. She's a Canadian woman. She did work quite closely with Patsy. So there was lots of really good voice work, but it never really, I never made the shift into text. So I never really understood how voice and movement actually helped you in the rehearsal or with the text or with the language or with the physicality of a scene. And and so one thing that I've really taken from the training was that my body was sort of effortlessly open and responding and impulsive and breath and, you know, all those things, because we did so much movement, whatever movement was, movement and voice and Alexander, it was a sort of lovely embodied sensation, but I don't feel that I knew how to actually put that, translate any of that into acting or use it as a skill. I think that's what it is. Being able to use the craft I've been given as a skill to inform what I'm doing in the rehearsal room.
And do you think you're right? I mean, do you think that was sitting inside you? So do you think that was an embodied knowledge which you had and that understanding how to apply it was unnecessary, or do you think there was actually a gap?
I think there was actually a gap. I mean, it's so when I came to my MA training, I was being told quite regularly not to explain anything to students. You just, I mean, it's a Trish Arnold, you know, lots of reputable practitioners work like that. They don't need to, you don't need to explain what you're doing to people. You just do it and they just take it on and embody it, and then it translates. And I struggled with that in my MA. I was a bit like, I guess because I'd had this experience at drama school where I was embodying all this work, but not really knowing why or how to use it or to have any grasp on it. You know, like you were saying earlier about the actor wanting to give the actor a skill that they can use and take with them, not just do it in the moment and then it leaves them. You know, I want to take that skill with me, and I want to be able to apply it in everything I do, whether I'm on a huge stage or in a tiny black box or in front of a camera or making up my own devised work or in the pub earning my, you know, hourly rate. You want to have that skill. And so I guess it's this battle of understanding and embodying, which I think I probably still battle with a bit.
Of definitely
how much to explain and how much not to explain, how much to trust the work, and how much does it actually help the actor to understand what they're doing. So whether at Manchester, I don't know whether that was a choice. You know, I mean, they were brilliant. It's like Niamh Dowling. I mean, she's completely brilliant, and Trish was brilliant, and the acting teachers were. I thought they were all great, but I. Yeah.
Trish Arnold.
Trish Bailey was the voice person.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was an actor and I worked for a bit. And.
But you hadn't encountered Trish Arnold's work at Manchester then?
I see. I always assumed that that was your. I always assumed that work had been part of your work as a drama student, and then you've been involved throughout your career. But that's really yeah. interesting. So
didn't know anything.
That's
about
kind of amazing. Yeah. You went to Guildhall thinking about being a voice teacher, and they said, "We think you should train yeah. to be a movement teacher."
Yeah, and I was 31, great. And I was, you know, I'd done a bit of acting, and I gave up, and I just got on much better with the crew and. You know, I loved the social life of it, but I didn't really want to be on the stage. And I'd worked in psychiatric wards for years and had sort of nearly gone mad. So when I ended up at Guildhall and they offered the movement place, I was like, well, yeah, all right then. Why? I mean, it really wasn't a sort of too much of a considered, it was just, I need to do something. I need to go somewhere with my life. I need to get some more training. I need to get, and I've always loved the theatre, the theatre offers, so I just took it. And so it was only in that first term really of training at Guildhall that people kept saying, oh, you move really well, or you're such a beautiful mover. And I was like, oh, really? I had no idea that I had a skill at moving, you know, or an understanding of weight and release and breath. And I had no idea who Trish Arnold was, and I just was dropped in as this first student and met Trish straight away at the beginning of the training, and she gave me some one-to-ones. I had to go off to her flat in Kilburn, and just got thrown in the deep end, really, and discovered how amazing the world was, and yeah, still here now, just...
Amazing. So how long was that MA?
It was 2 years. It was meant to be 2 years part-time, but you just threw yourself in and, you know, followed all the actors around, went to every movement class. I went to all Patsy's classes as well. I just leapt back in. I loved the fact that I was back training and back in a drama school and back in a learning environment, but as a, you know, in my early 30s, not my early 20s, and even those 10 years made a huge difference. So I just soaked up everything. I went to every class you could imagine, just did everything, yeah, and learnt it and followed Wendy around, and she is brilliant, and I observed how she taught. And I guess it's the learning how to teach is the interesting bit, and that's, you know, I know you did the central course. It's you could observe endlessly, but actually to learn how to teach is something that you do after your training. You then have to sort of learn on the job, and you learn through lots of mistakes, and you have those 3 years of just not having a clue what you're doing, really. And discovering how to pass on what you've experienced and what you understand in your body. How do you pass that on to other people? And I think that bit of my work only then really, really deepened when I went to Lambda. So I was at RADA to start with, a Mount View. I was doing lots of work at Mount View, lots of work at Drama Centre. You know, as a new teacher, you're sort of running around everywhere. I actually got asked by the RSC. I met Stuart and Leslie. He was up there as head of movement, and he asked me to go and work at the RSC with him. And I said, oh, I'm just about to have my first child, just hang on. And then the Lambda job came up, head of movement at Lambda. Wendy said, oh, you should apply. So I chucked my application form in, and it was Jane Gibson was on the panel at Lambda. And then they phoned me up a couple of days later and said, we're not going to give you head of movement, but we would like you to come to Lambda and teach, and we're going to pay for Jane Gibson to mentor you. For a 2-year mentorship. And I guess I had these sort of amazing options. Jane Gibson, when I was at Guildhall, Jane Gibson was this figure of real, I don't know, everyone just looked up to her. She was this sort of amazing movement director. No one had really met her. I certainly hadn't met her before. She was the first mentee of Trish Arnold. Was head of movement at the National, worked, you know, associate director of Cheek by Jowl. So I was quite amazed that actually she was going to wanted to train me, and Lambda were going to support that. And I had this position at the RSE that I could have taken, so I had a really difficult choice, but went with the Jane Gibson one because I just thought the getting much more detail in the work and learning how to teach it on a deeper level would be really valuable.
Why do you think Lambda invested in you and the teaching in that way? What was because that's quite a thing, isn't it, to be given a 2-year mentorship supported entirely by an institution? Was that something they saw in you, or was that to do with the fact that they wanted the work to be part of the training? What do you know what the thinking was there?
I think two things. I think because there is this strong lineage of movement work at Lambda. So Trish Arnold was there in the 50s, developed all of her work at Lambda. She passed it on to Jane Gibson, who was also there, was an apprentice, and then carried the work on at Lambda. Rodney was taught in that style of movement work. If it's a style, I don't know, it's probably the wrong word. Johnny Baxter, who was the head of movement, was taught by Jane. There was a real strong sense of that work in the building anyway. But there had been a little gap where this particular work hadn't actually been taught there because Jane left and went out into the profession. Mm-hmm. And other things came in, you know, equally wonderful things. And I, for some reason, I don't know why they got Jane onto the audition panel. I don't know, maybe that was a Rodney show, because it would have been Joanna at the time, who was principal.
When we talk about Rodney, we're talking about Rodney Cartier.
Yes, yeah.
Who's currently still at Lambda, although I think leaving soon. And yeah. Rodney was the head of the acting course. I mean, Rodney's had various positions over the years, but sort
head of
was
drama school, isn't he?
Head of drama school. Mm. Yeah, but sort of almost the spirit of Lambda for quite some time.
Yeah, indeed. So whether it was him that had got Jane in, I don't know, actually. But she was on this audition panel, and I think they were quite keen to get that work back in to Lambda to follow on the lineage, the tradition. You know, I mean, not just because of the lineage and the tradition, because the work works.
Yeah, presumably they were seeing an absence. Presumably what they had identified was something they thought was missing from the training. I mean, that would be my...
Yeah.
You'd hope, wouldn't you? You'd hope that would be the thinking.
Yeah. And then I think the second part of it was that Jane has been, and quite rightly with it, I mean, James was saying about Yat, that people can be very protective about their work. And Jane had been very protective about her work and hadn't passed it on to anyone. And I think she'd got to a point in her career where she felt it was actually important to pass the work on. So she obviously, I don't know, saw me in the audition and thought I could move all right and decided that I was the one that she wanted to pass the work on to. And knowing that I'd been at Guildhall and that I'd worked with Trish anyway and that I had some understanding of the work. So yeah, I mean, it was quite a remarkable thing. It's a big investment. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of financial investment. It was a really unique thing. I don't think it had happened anywhere before for a drama school to actually commit to training on the job, training a teacher in order for them to embed the work really deeply into the school. And that's essentially what happened. I mean, the mentorship went on for over 3 years. And I taught lots and still carried on teaching at RADA. Then the mentorship finished. And I mean, to this day, I still check in with Jane, and she used to come and watch my classes at Lambda every now and then and just sort of keep on top of it. Until obviously very recently, where I'm now no longer at Lambda. But I think Jane, I think there's still a connection. You know, I don't know how much the work will continue there, but I think there are still links with the work. yeah, that's it, really.
Maybe at the end of the interview, we can return to the end of your time at Lambda, because that's a story I'd like to talk to you about. I would be interested to know how that happened and what you think about that. But because this podcast is concerned with the history of actor training, and now we have a sense about your journey from student at Manchester to actor to doing the MA at Guildhall, finding Trish's work, was your MA at Guildhall in Trish's work? Was that most of the training or a big chunk of it? Or
yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it's the Guildhall training at the time was very much about Trish's work. So Trish had been teaching at Lambda for many, many years, was head of movement. She then went over to Guildhall and was head of movement at Guildhall. So then she sort of passed on the work to various people there, like Sue Lefton, Jackie Snow, Wendy Allnut, who then carried on. Wendy took over as head of movement, Danny McGraw as well. So the ethos behind the movement work at Guildhall was absolutely based on Trish Arnold's work. And you know, like in all trainings, whoever's doing the work puts their own sort of flavour in it. And Wendy was an actor, brilliant actor herself, and is a great director. And she took the work and connected it to acting and did lots of projects. But the movement work sort of filtered into everything, which was brilliant. I mean, it was absolutely brilliant. So you had sort of Patsy's work and Wendy's work that fed the whole of the training. So I think I was very lucky to be there at that time because I'm not sure if Guildhall is like that so much now, but, you know, it's a thing, it's a different thing. It may have its own brilliance now, but at the time I felt very lucky to be involved in those two very established training ethos. I don't know how you'd explain it.
Now, all that training is really hard to talk about, isn't it? It's something that I'm realizing even more and more talking to people, because we can sort of sketch out histories. We can talk about where people came from or what they did, but I think it's really difficult actually to articulate what this thing is that we all teach. Notoriously difficult. So let's have a go. I think it would be really good fun to try and get somewhere with this question, because I know when I was an actor, for instance, and when I was a voice teacher, I don't think I understood any of it. I don't think I understood voice work. I don't think I really understood what an acting class was. I certainly didn't understand what a movement class was. I know what a coaching session is, and I know what a choreographer is, and those things are really clear. So maybe we should. Is that somebody sawing?
Yeah, I've got an. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
An extension. It's hell. I mean, it's absolute hell. So I've asked them to try and keep the noise down, not do any insane drilling. So, yeah, there might be the odd saw.
Comic sawing. yeah, it's good. There'll be a sort of plank will come over your head and you duck down. Also sounds a bit like people having sex next door. So that's, anyway. Those days.
There's really nothing so exciting.
Those days are gone.
In Cambridge. It's good old-fashioned sawing. Yeah.
Okay, very good. That's good. That's reassuring. So let's talk about, so Trish Arnold's work. Now, I've got a feeling that of the sort of the big bunches of work that would go on in drama schools, I think I've got a feeling that Trish's work might sort of be some of the least well-known, or that maybe her as a self-publicist, or that as a label, is not something that people have an understanding for. They might know about Alexander Technique. They might have heard of Kristen. They might even know something about certainly Laban and maybe Yats. But I think the Trish work is a little bit lower on people's sort of radar. Yeah. So let's talk about Trish. So who is Trish Arnold? Where did she come from? What was she up to?
So Trish Arnold, she was born in 1918 in Scotland, and she trained as a classical ballet dancer at the Sadler's Wells Ballet. She worked as a classical dancer for a few years with the Royal Ballet Company. In fact, I found a copy of her CV the other day, and she says on her from 1976, and she says she worked on film, she worked in theatre as a dancer, as a ballet dancer. So She's got quite an extensive career as classical dancer. She then got married, had children, and then post-children, she started to teach ballet to young people and realised that she was just a bit bored with it. And it was, in fact, I saw a little clip of her speaking about it the other day, and she said it just felt really unnatural teaching this very restrained style to small children. And so she, I think, started sort of exploring other avenues, and through a friend she met Sigurd Lader, who was, I think he'd call himself a modern dancer at the time, so this is sort of 1940s, mm-hmm. Maybe
just pre-war.
A bit later, no, but it must be a bit later. Yeah, it must be late 40s, mm-hmm. early 50s. Mm-hmm. Sigurd Lader she met in the early 50s. And she then joined his dance company. And then, this is why I'm hopeless at these things, because I just can't remember names and dates.
It's not important, doesn't matter.
He set up something like the Modern Dance School. He was mm-hmm. in London. You know, they're all... So Sigurd Lader worked with Kurt Jooss and mm-hmm. Laban, and they were all part of this Dartington crew. So it's interesting hearing James's talk about Yat and Christopher and all those connections. They're all part of the same movement. Mm-hmm. Same movement. So mm-hmm. Sigurd Lader and Kurt Jooss did that, the very famous piece, The Green Table. Is it The Green Table, I think it's called? And then Sigurd Lader came to London and set up his own school, and that's where Trish ended up. And she trained with him for 2 years. So because of the connections to the work that Sigurd Lader had done with Laban and Kurt Jooss, it was all about swings and weight and free flow. I mean, again, just mirrors all the things that James was talking about with Yat's work. Mm-hmm. And Trish absolutely adored it, just found it so... She talks, when you used to hear her talk about Sigurd Lader, she would light up. Just how different it was to the classical style. So she did that for a couple of years, and then it was the Lambda connection came because Michael... So you'll have to help me on names again. Under pressure, I can't remember anyone's name.
No. Norman, Michael McCowan.
Yes, and Norman Ayrton. They approached Sigurd Lader because obviously there's all those connections. They knew Sigurd Lader. They all the connections with the Old Vic School and Litzpisk. And, mm-hmm. They approached Sigurd Lader and said, "Do you have anyone who you think might be interesting to teach movement at Lambda?" And Sigurd Lader suggested Trish. And so she went off to have an audition at Lambda with Michael and Norman. And she did a couple of swings. And because of their work and history and relationship with Michel Saint-Denis and all that connection, they thought, brilliant, yeah, great, and employed Trish to teach movement. And this is a sort of interesting bit for Trish because she was a dancer. She hadn't even thought about breath or the voice. And when she turned up at Lambda and started teaching, it was Iris Warren. So there's a famous quote from Trish that Iris Warren turned up, you know, in her class, very sort of dominating, formidable woman, and said, "I hope you're not going to do anything that stops them breathing." And Trish admits that she hadn't even thought about the breath. She was a dancer, hadn't thought about the voice. So basically she learnt on the job. She adapted all of the work that she'd understood from Sigurd Lader and she had worked with as a modern dancer, and translated it for the actor and made all of the movements enable the actor to breathe and speak and find the fluidity to express with spoken word as well as through the body. And that's, yeah, then she just carried on at Lambda and developed the work and ended up being head of movement all during that period. Because I think Norman was head of movement when Trish was there, and then Trish took over from Norman.
And Norman became principal.
Yeah. Mm. And then all during those years, sort of late, I think it was 55, she ended up at Lambda, and then on until late 70s. That's where she met Kristen Linklater, because Kristen came back to Lambda. Kristen was taught by Trish, although Kristen herself says she doesn't really remember much of the work with Trish as a student. But when she came back to Lambda to teach, she obviously started to understand and work alongside Trish. And they basically developed a whole body of work to do with the body and the voice together. And Kristen, then when she went off to America and set up the Shakespeare Company, Shakespeare and Company, and I think she taught in Massachusetts. Oh, Kristen's wonderful.
Minnesota,
that was it. Yeah. Amazing developments in her work. She employed Trish, so she took Trish with her, shipped her over to America, and did all of the workshops, the Stratford Festival. Trish was over there quite a lot. So in fact, the book that I'm putting together about all this work, Kristen gave me a lovely quote just before she died, actually, about the work that her and Trish were doing at Lambda, and how most of Kristen's work on freeing the actor's voice, the body side of it, comes from Trish's movement work. Kristen still worked with a woman called Mary Conway in America, and Mary still, even now, is continuing the sort of collaboration of body and voice, and runs workshops and things. So that was one aspect of Trish's work, was the connection to voice and Kristen. She worked a lot at the Royal Court, so she became quite a big movement director. But directors were shipping her out. She did loads of work at the Royal Court. She also set up Common Stock, which with Frank Whitten, which was a really first community theatre. So Trish was a co-founder of that. So she was really popular and dynamic, and was sort of in the main, globally, like internationally. She was all over the place doing this incredible work. But no one really knew about her. So that's what's weird.
No. Yeah. So just I'm really interested. So going back a little bit, so she's auditioned for Lambda, or interviewed for the job at Lambda.
Yeah.
They're looking for something at the time, and I think this is something that I've got to understand more and more, is that the tradition or the way of doing things that we were a part of was part of a sort of desperate search, I think, during that middle of the 20th century. It wasn't that there's been a kind of handing on from the setting up of RADA and Central. It's that there was, I think, a dissatisfaction and even a crisis in British theatre, mostly actor-led, actually, or actor and, I suppose, what then became director-led. Mm. And the drama schools were people like Michael McCowan. They didn't know how to do it. I mean, the Old Vic School had closed, the London Theatre Studio had closed, Michael Chekhov had gone to America from Darlington Hall, Komar Zajewski had gone back to America. So all of these interesting sort of people who offered some kind of hope for a British theatre that would be like a European art theatre, like the theatre of the French they'd seen, or the Russians. I think that's what the people wanted, and didn't know how to do it. So Michael McCowan wants to set up a drama school which will in some way replace the Old Vic School. And they start looking for people. Yeah. They start trying to find a way to assemble that. And there are some people who've worked with Michel Saint-Denis, and they go to those people. But they don't actually know what they're doing, I think. They know they're full of intelligence and art and knowledge, but they don't actually know how to train a whole actor. So Trish walks in. They see something in her, and she starts teaching. And what she's teaching is related to a form of contemporary dance. Is that what you would call that word?
Modern dance, I guess. Really, yeah.
Modern dance.
Yeah. That has come out of Laban, has worked, has connects to Laban. That's, the other important link, I think.
That's the link. So she's teaching that work, and I suppose Michael McCowan and Norman Aitken are hoping that will create actors who are as improvisatory and free and creative and sort of, I mean, you read about the things that Saint-Denis companies did, and it just sounds sort of, you know, extraordinary, total theatre, physical theatre, I suppose, or that sort of type of stuff. But she doesn't. So that's what they're hoping from her. Mm. So she starts teaching her classes, and she's teaching a dance class, and then we have this Iris Warren comes in, and they have that conversation, and obviously it must have resonated with her. So she must have then watched people acting and realized that was a good note, or a more than a note, but a really crucial thing to understand.
Yeah.
So then when she's teaching, what is she hoping will happen? What's she trying to do to the actors in her class? And in fact, what are you doing? So when you meet first year actors and you've inherited this and developed this tradition, you've got this work, you've got swings, you've got all kinds of vocabularies. What are you trying to give them, or what are you trying to turn them into? What's actually happening in that work?
Well, I think at the beginning, in the very early stages, you're trying, I mean, this is so hard. This is why it's so hard.
It's hard. I know.
I'm trying to write this book, and it's just, you know, it's ridiculous, because I could do the work. I could do it. I could do it in my body, but putting into words, it just makes it sound so sort of futile, and it's not. So sometimes it's best just not to speak about it. I mean, I guess I was trying to really keep it simple, it would be about connecting them to weight, giving them an opportunity so they can understand the weight of their body. And that is where release, that's where they'll discover release. And that's how they'll begin to let go of tensions that are unhelpful. I mean, this is, you know, talking to you, so you don't know this, but you clearly, this is the same in voice to a certain extent. I mean, your piece that when you were reading out about Christian Linklater's views on how to act, to train an actor, it would be mm-hmm. exactly the same for the body. Mm-hmm. You start with yourself, you connect to weight, you think about alignment, you think about placement. I mean, this phrase comes up quite a lot, good placement. It's tricky because, you know, it suggests that there's bad placement, but yeah, there is. I mean, there is unhelpful placement that affects expression coming out freely, mm-hmm. clarity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that at an early stage, that's what you're trying to do, get them to understand that there are unhelpful tensions in us all, find a little bit more alignment, strength is really important. You know, the right sort of muscularity, the strength around the spine. For me personally, I really get them connected to their spine, get them to feel the center of the body. And then you start sort of playing with free flow, with swings, because they're all about weight and space and that relationship of near to far. They start to give you an understanding of breath, of breath that releases effortlessly, that links into the spoken word. The swing connects you out into space, you know, thinking about audience, thinking about space behind you. I guess that would be all the sort of early part of the training. And then when the body's in a place where they have a bit more understanding of their own body, or they have a little bit more control isn't the right word, but yeah, the body is working for them rather than against them. They have choice. Well, you want them to have choice, don't you? I could choose to do this. I choose to do that. That then they can be incredibly playful. And then you know, by the time I get to the second year, they've had a really rigorous year of training, and it really does shift in the second year. The movements become more dynamic. I use a lot of Litzpisk work as well, because that's what Jane has passed on, the Trish Arnold and the Litzpisk. And they do some movement work, and then it frees them to the last part of the class, where they improvise and play and create, and we use text quite a lot. Yeah, and there's a whole other world of you know, areas that you can go into, like mask work and animal work. I used to do all the animal work at Lambda. I used to do it at RADA. I don't anymore because I don't have the time. You know, so you can take it into all these other areas. You can focus on sort of what's considered movement. What do they call it at Lambda? It's a bit more specific. It's like you might work on elements, or you might work on deadly sins, or you sort of focus it into a particular area. Does that sound clear at all?
we're on our way, aren't we? Any sense? No, totally. It makes lots of sense. I mean, it is difficult. It is difficult to talk about. But if we're talking about weight and what it means to move that into a more dynamic place of expression, but still holding on to that. I mean, I think that's crucial, isn't it? Because the moment the performance hits, or the moment the need to do something hits, that inevitably produces often huge amounts of tension in all kinds of places, which is parasitic and unhelpful. So I think that's a lot of what we're all doing in the training, is getting people into a place where they can work from. You just generate jargon, don't you? You can call it a center, or call it good use, or call it weight, or whatever you call it. But it's a, although we only have words to describe it, when you see it, or when you have an experience of it, it's palpable and it's powerful and it's clear. So the work on mask and the work on animal studies, that work, I suppose, also comes from Suzanne Bing's teaching. There are multiple routes in, I suppose.
I mean, I think for Trish, it was the Michel Saint-Denis aspect. It was being in Lambda and being around all the people who had absorbed and had worked with Michel Saint-Denis and were carrying on that tradition. She soaked it all up there. She did end up going and working with Jacques Lecoq for a bit. She did a 3-month-long course or something with Jacques Lecoq. So that... She did some evening workshops with Litz Pisk. She, you know, as we all do, we soak up what we can get. But I think the mask and the animal work, it came out of the Michel Saint-Denis tradition.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. I think there's a teacher called Suzanne Bing, who's often mentioned now, who worked with Coppo and who has probably generated or originated some of that work. Yeah. The swings. So in a way, if we were talking, I mean, and maybe this is, I think it's okay to be simple, isn't it? We can get somewhere with a simple thing. So when I've watched your work and when students do your work, the swings seem to be a sort of a signature part of it. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so the swings come directly from, I've forgotten his name, but...
Sigurd Leder.
So that's he did, they were kind of his work.
Yes, his work in the sense that he worked with Kurt Jos, who also worked with Laban. So they're all talking about the same thing: the sense of free flow instead of the bound, held, presented forms of movement or dance. So. Trish was one who would always say that she's never, you know, I'm writing the book saying she's pioneered all this movement work, but Trish would say I didn't invent this. I've just developed it from so and so, so and so, and so and so. But that's what we all do.
But she at least does develop that work and makes it something which is for an actor training rather than for a dance training. And is there more to that than, I mean, in terms of how you would note that, or the way you would lead it, or when you embody it for people, what is it you're embodying? Breath is one part of it. Is there more than that? The difference between dance and training a dancer and training an actor. What are the differences there?
Well, I think for me, I could. So I've just, if you look at this film that Mary Conway did of Trish Arnold, she made a film, partly because it's so hard to articulate in written form work. And it does sound very simplistic when you talk about it, and it absolutely isn't simplistic. When she's interviewing various movement people on this film, they all talk so beautifully about the swing. They really, Jane Gibson talks with such articulation about it, Sue Lefton, Shona Morris, they all they all have this understanding of the swing. I just don't feel I could talk about it, but it sort of moves me. That's all I can say, is that on a personal level, they have all the humanity in them. So what I absolutely adore about the work is the playing with the drop and the suspension, this release of weight and the sort of natural rebound that comes out. When you let go of weight, you naturally rebound out of it, back away from gravity. And for me, in those moments is hope and despair. And it's that sense of just giving up and giving in, and that you just spring back into a place of hope and into the next impulse and into the next moment. And the swings have it, and the swings, they connect your center of your body, your sensation, your thought, your feeling, your emotion. They connect everything internally, externally, because it constantly travels from one point to another point, and then it repeats and it returns. And I guess, you know, on a really crude way of explaining it, it's that sense of life. It just keeps going and keeps going, and there is a drop, and there is really awful bits, and there are joyous, delightful moments of excitement and suspension. And
yeah, no, I get that. That's really profound. Now I understand, you see, because I can I completely, that's beautiful, because that's life, isn't it? Like when you let go, when you finally let go, and you discover yourself, when you encounter that, and then you express that, or you do what you want to do, there's real majesty in that. And as an actor, you're constantly treading that line between trying to control and even your set. You know, I often think on a bad night as an actor, as the words are coming through your mouth, you're sort of trying to make them do what you want them to do as they're coming through you. And that, then it never works. Yeah. None of it really, nothing happens. Yeah. And so the balance between discipline and diligence and chaos and play and trust ultimately is, it's easy to say, blimey. Yeah. It's easy to say to an actor, you have to trust, to trust it. You have to let go. But incredibly difficult to do. And so if that for you sort of has inside it almost that experience, both as an experience but also as a metaphor, that makes complete sense. And that's you're right, that's a profound thing, because that is like, it's like prayer, isn't it? It's like, I mean, I'm not Christian or religious at all, but I remember one night when my youngest son was quite badly injured, and I was in a hospital with him, and we were waiting for the surgery, and they weren't sure whether he was concussed or brain damaged, or it was just one of those terrible, terrible, terrible nights. And I remember crying, and it was a kind of crying I'd never done before, because the tears just kept on flowing and flowing and flowing and flowing and flowing. And I prayed to whatever God I could sort of find, and just said, forgive me, I've been a rubbish person. You know, it was almost like being a little boy. You know, if you just make him okay, I promise to be good. I promise to be good again. But I remember having a physical sensation in that moment of just kind of giving in and letting go and feeling completely hopeless and sort of encountering something that was really, felt really, it was quite nice feeling. Yeah. I had to go, help me. Yeah. Actually, I felt sort of safe in that. Yeah. And so maybe all of that's somewhere in your swing.
I think it is. I think it's, you know, I think it's the risk. Like, they, you know, we talk about risk for actors and not staying safe and not staying comfortable. And I often find myself saying the risk is in just letting go. Like, that in itself is a huge risk. I mean, particularly now in this present environment, you know, with COVID, everyone is holding on. And I think it's really important to find a space where you can let go. It's incredibly vulnerable. It's incredibly exposing. What I guess personally for me, and what I can see the actors are exploring and discovering, is that if you can connect to the, Trish always used to talk about it like a balance of technique and expression, that the technique is there in order to enable the expression. And for me, if an actor can find their spine and their center and they have specificity and they understand direction and they have clarity in what they're doing with their body, then when they let go, they can completely let go. And it's safe. It's safe because it's sort of contained within the technique. And it doesn't become sort of psychodrama. It doesn't touch. I mean, yes, we know that it touches on all of that, but that's not my intention. My intention is to give them a safe space where they can absolutely risk with the weight of their body and trust that that rebound is always there, that they can give up and they bounce back. They can come back to a place of stability and centering and that is incredibly expressive and artistic. And in every play, every single text that they work on, whether it's, you know, EastEnders or Shakespeare, there are all of those moments in every character's life because it's human. It's about humanity. There's a moment of drop and a moment of suspension. And that's why, I guess for me as the actor, or what interested me about acting in the first place is having some, I don't know, playing with humanity and all its different possibilities, and the work really offers that, and it offered it with space and silence and, you know, and not too much talking. Like, it's a big thing not to do loads and loads of talking, just to keep quiet, give them the space to have their own experience, and then they can send it on to another actor or into a scene or into a play or to an audience, but it has to all happen in a very safe place.
So the work that you teach is very shaped. So it's very structured. It's a very elegantly constructed pedagogy. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, I think it is. And structure, yes, there is. I mean, I'm a bit nervous about saying that because I've been attacked and accused in the past of the work having rigidity, because some people mistake structure as being something sort of rigid and fixed. And why can't the actors just like roll around the floor whenever they want? Why can't they ask questions whenever they want? Why can't they go and get water whenever they want? Well, that's all part of sort of creating a space that is held and contained and held and contained enough so they can have really revealing moments. And there is a technique. Sorry.
No, God, no. I feel the same way, and I feel that by offering a space like that, you actually make a safe space.
Absolutely.
A genuinely safe space. So that this is something I keep on thinking, is that there's a politics to that too, and it's not necessarily a negative politics.
Yeah. I agree. And also you're creating a space where if necessary, an actor or a student can hit against that. You know, they can find the frustration of why can't I fidget and why can't I shuffle and why can't I disconnect when I want to disconnect? And you know, and we come across that all the time. Students get really fed up when they want to ask a question in the middle of a moment or in the middle of a movement. And I say, no, just hold it, partly because you might be able to answer it yourself. If you trust yourself, you might discover the answer, which is much better for you than me telling you. But also it's sort of interrupting the moment that you're in. It's interrupting the experience that you're in. Wait till the end of the session. And that's really hard for some people, but that is also my job, is to create that space where, you know, like a child and a parent, you have to hold their shit, don't you? You have to take it and not react back. You have to create the space for them to, you have to create the boundaries for them to, you know, bash their heads against. And that is also misunderstood. That's very misunderstood. by people who don't understand the work or don't understand what we're doing in the space.
And did you find that out, or were you taught that by your mentors? Was that something that's been, because I think that's completely true, and I'm not sure most people understand that. I mean, I don't know how I know that. I don't know whether I was ever taught that, or whether I saw it, or whether I figured it out, or whether I spoke to colleagues in staff rooms. Yeah. But that aspect of the work,
I think that's probably a lot of that is down to Jane Gibson. I mean, partly Trish as well, mm-hmm. and obviously it influenced Wendy's work and my training at Guildhall. But I think at that early stage, I was just learning the movements. I was just getting my head around having to be able to stand up in front of people and teach. I mean, even that was sort of terrifying. When I worked with Jane, she really instilled in me that sense of holding the space and not filling it with words. You know, I look through all my mentorship notes and it constantly says, stop talking, trust the drum. The drum creates the dynamic, give students the space to have their own experience. And if I talk through everything, I'm putting my input onto them and they have to discover it for themselves. So I think Jane did sort of really pull that out. And that comes from Trish, because that's how Trish would have taught. You know, don't like let them have their experience. Let them discover for themselves. And I think that's what good pedagogy is. That's what good teaching is. Because we're there with them for such a short amount of time, really. And, you know, if you remember your training, I remember my training. I was just like, oh, floating through it. All right, well, you know, when can I go to the pub? Right, really committed and loving it, but just doing it, just not thinking about it. I mean, that is part of being young and being in a training. So, yeah, that's my job, is to let them have their experience and then they discover answers themselves and they take that on for themselves. They take it on when I'm not there with them in a play, you know, or in a film studio. And I've had so many lovely emails from ex-students saying how much the work just stays with them and helps them keep together and helps them be unemployed. And, you know, I had one student say, I just want to thank you because my gran died of COVID and I've been doing your work regularly and it just keeps me together. And there's that wonderful balance of, it gives them weight and swing and freedom and release and expression, but it also has a containment and a structure and some boundaries, and that keeps people together, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Tell me, let's go kind of off piste a little bit. So tell me a teaching experience you've had that really moved you or changed you, or tell me a story about something that happened that's changed the direction of your work. Let's try that. Anything pop to mind?
I don't know how much of a story it is. I think things like when my dad a couple of years ago died of cancer, got cancer and, you know, was dead sort of 3 months later. And working through that, you know, that stuff going on personally. I mean, obviously we all bring a bit of ourselves into our teaching, but at the end of the day, we are the teacher and it's their experience, isn't it? It's not, you know, so I keep my stuff to myself. I don't chat to students personally. I don't know anything about them really. You know, I keep that sort of professional boundary. And I think the students I was teaching at Lambda at the moment must have known about it. No, I was doing a movement, that's it. I was doing a sort of spine undulation and I just burst into tears. It was the release in the spine, the movement, the expression in the movement, that just, you know, I couldn't sort of contain it anymore. And they were all sort of very supportive and very quiet. And just that sense of them getting them into their bodies where collectively we were all in this space of supporting each other and being really open with, like, that sort of blurred line of, you know, revealing, expressive, but contained. It's not really a story, but it was just a real moment, a real palpable moment where I was sort of standing in front of this group of young actors, and they were all in this incredibly open place. I think it was the first time I've really felt what it is when people talk about being open and available and in the moment, and all these, like you say, catchphrases that get thrown around. And as an actor, I didn't really have any clue what they were talking about, but that was a moment I went, oh yeah, this is what the work does. It contains you, it supports you, it allows me to support them. In some way, they were supporting me because I'd shown some vulnerability. And we just carried on through the movements. It was just a very moving experience. And I think I don't know, yeah, that must, they all influence. They all influence, don't they? I mean, I can't think of any other stories. I mean, I've got horrible, everyone has awful stories of terrible teaching at the beginning where you just can't withstand what happens in the space. Like students can be quite bullying, can't they, sometimes when you're a new student, when you're a new teacher. I think the mentorship really helped me to, you know, loads of really deep experiences in that mentorship where I learnt about my own fidgetiness and my own unwillingness to just be still and commit to what I'm doing or what I'm saying in that moment. Jane used to say, why are you fidgeting? I've got one bit of notes. Why are you keep fidgeting all the time? You're like a ditzy schoolgirl. Because every time I spoke, I was sort of shuffling around. Wow. When I came, you know, through a long process, when I came into a place where I could be still, I now walk into any class or any rehearsal or any situation, and we start with stillness and silence, and I hold it, and I insist that they hold it, and then we begin the work, and that, you know, little things like that, then. They're not funny stories, but they're moments.
No, I wasn't. No, I wasn't after a funny story. I'm looking for things that help us to really see and to get at least a sense about what happens in our rooms. Because I think, as I was saying at the beginning, people will say that acting teachers who work in the conservatoire or drama schools, whatever you want to call it, are kind of silent about their work. But I think that's partly because no one ever asks us. Like like people are seeking. No one. I mean, you know, I could go for years without anybody asking me anything about what I did. You know, and just people, I got employed lots, and people, I presume somebody liked the work. I don't know, but it's not secret because we're keeping it a secret. It's secret because partly because nobody seems to want to know, and partly because it's hard to talk about, because often you're dealing with things. I mean, when you told that story, I can imagine that, and I'm sure most people listening can. So I know what that tangibly is like, to be in a room with people who are in a different place or a different space, and the thing is, when you're in that, you go, oh, that's a bit like when I saw Michael Gambon being a phenomenal crap in Crap's Last Tape, or when I went to see Slava's Snow Show, or when the Russians came over and I saw their extraordinary, they were kind of like that energy in the room. Energy is another jargon word, isn't it? But it's hard to do without it. That's it. That right there is the thing that we want to be working with more and more and more and more and more if we want to make really, really good theatre. Yeah. And that's all great TV or proper film or whatever. And you can see when you meet extraordinary people, really good actors, really good directors, they're in that space. So that's what we were after, I think.
I think that's what they want. That's what the students want, isn't it? Because they feel that. They understand that.
Absolutely, because they're talented. And they,
yeah,
exactly. Which is why the work of most teachers, I think, at Lambda and RADA most. I don't know about everybody's particular practice or students' relationships with everybody. Like you, I would try not to talk to them about it too much. But my sense is that an awful lot of the work was achieving that, was giving them that experience, and that because they're artists, like you say, they're hungry for that. And that I don't think is going to change. Like, I wonder if I was a brilliant, ambitious, artistic, imaginative 18-year-old in London right now, and I'm thinking, where do I go to get this experience that's going to move me a long way along the journey of doing something extraordinary? I think there's still going to be a few folk knocking around who want that. I don't know where they go to get it. I don't know. People often ask me for recommendations, and I'm less and less sure what to say.
I think it'll be sort of not short courses. I think it'll be private courses or private workshops. Yeah. I think there'll be, there'll be people setting up. I mean, I've done it myself, but, and I know other people are doing it and thinking about doing it, and spaces where you just go and you pay a fee for a class, and you might go regularly because you can and you love it and you want it and you get hungry, and rather than it being all sort of contained in one training. I don't know. I mean, I like to hope that it won't disappear entirely. It's very tempting to give it all up, I must admit. The other thing to point out, I think, lots of people are, I think often it comes from sort of fear, or because when they don't understand, or when people can't quite understand what we do in the space, but they see the effect it has on the students. Partly one of the slight downfalls, I don't know if that is true, but if the students really love your work, it's not me that they love. It's they love the work. They love the experience of coming into the session and repeating and exploring, discovering new stuff, and the consistency of that, the continuation of that. People who don't understand what happens in that space get a bit fearful about it, or they get a bit unnerved by it. And certainly I know body work, anything to do with the body, if you're not naturally connected to your body, it's quite intimidating. It's quite exposing. I think it gets labelled as this sort of weird thing that they're doing in the room, and it all gets a bit guru-y, and the students love it, but no one can explain what's happening, and no one really talks about what they are doing. Things like Trish Arnold, they're not known. Like, I don't know, Meisner, like you were saying about Meisner, you can just go Meisner and that's it. Everyone knows, everyone has an understanding, everyone can link onto it, catch onto it. Like, you can't do that with really good movement work, unless it's Laban, which is Laban by itself is not so about actor training, it's like, that's the thing about Yat, isn't it? It was the collective, the amalgamation of the work and then putting it into actor training. But so I think people get scared, and that's why things get cut and taken out, because it's...
Well, also, the people that often end up running drama schools have never had the experience of being trained. I mean, it's sort of agonizing, as you end up with lots of people either running or administering, even at an artistic level, because often they're drawn from the world of directors or dramaturgs or people who use actors and use the stuff of actor training, but have never been through it. So until you've actually had the experience of changing, of what it is to be changed, transformed in yourself before you transform, it's, how would you know? How would you have a clue? I often say to people, when I started teaching in drama schools, I'd been an actor for years and I'd done an MA in voice studies, and I started teaching at RADA and Lambda, and I didn't really have a clue. It took me a long time to understand and to watch and to see change in people, and to see that often people were owning something which even they didn't understand. Like, they wouldn't know what had happened to them. They'd become something. They turned into something, and what they turned into was a much more free, creative, effective, artistic being. And then they have careers based on that, and they make work. And they don't know. They don't know where it was that connection was made necessarily. Yeah. So actors also aren't always the best people to ask about their training.
And I think the other misunderstanding is that they think that we're after change, you know, that sense of transformation and change that is somehow taking away from your own identity, you know, another sort of dangerous word to use and put out there. But that's a real mistake. That is such a mistake to think that the work that I would be doing in the room is taking away from someone's identity or someone's cultural background. It's enhancing it. It's entirely about your own identity in order to then have choice over what you're doing with your instruments and who you are and put it into something else or play someone else who has a different identity or a different desire. And I think that's also a mistake. I keep hearing people saying to me these ridiculous statements about movement and, oh, because it's all about, you know, training the want.
Court body. I've heard things. Have you heard that one? You know, it's sort of a 19th century or white courtly body. And you kind of think, I mean,
I can certainly not,
you know, Alexander lost his voice. He was an actor. He lost his voice. He was in trouble of not being able to make his living. So he worked out what he was doing. And then he found a way of changing that. Yeah. That's not about the politics of identity. That's about being able to speak on a Thursday night when you need to do a show. I think that's the crux of this. Like, what about who are you to tell me that I can't experience different things? Who are you to say that I shouldn't develop choice in the way I do stuff with my body or my voice or my breath or my mouth? What's the politics of that? Like I find that almost more than anything else a terrible repression. Yeah. Don't understand why we've decided that it's okay to tell people you are what you are, and we will simply kind of give that you are a little polish and a bit of, you have to stay that. We'll give you confidence and maybe, and you can practice endlessly being you, and then you can leave. I get that it's really complicated working with people's identity and sense of self.
Yeah.
I think it's really complicated.
And requires real sensitivity as well, you know.
Real sensitivity and care. And I think it could be screwed up in all kinds of terrible ways. And I think all kinds of terrible things are said to actors in training. Yeah. And, you know, genuinely horrendous things. So I don't think it's simple. But I don't think it's simple, and I certainly really resent being told that it is that you know people should just be left as they are.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, I think we've got somewhere with talking about Trish and talking about your work, and I don't know whether you can bear it, but I quite like finishing these on with the sort of the tale of how it came to an end. So you were working within Trish's tradition. You'd been mentored at great expense by the Lambda students in a way. I mean, you know, they're paying their fees. So Lambda had invested in you. You'd been, and I have to say, I'm not sure if I've ever said this to you, but I remember working with you at RADA on a show. I think it was Medea, I think we worked on. And of course the work was brilliant. And then right at the end of our time at Lambda, or close to the end, we worked on a production of The Country Wife, which I was really proud of. And, loved working with you, of course. And I remember thinking, wow, you know, I almost with a sort of slight irritation, I don't think in that time I changed very much. I don't think I learned much or, but you were transformed. You were a wonderful teacher before, but by the time you came into my room for The Country Wife, you were kind of a stellar teacher. So I could see the effect in you, more in you, actually. It's interesting what you said about Trish's notes, which says something about the vigorous and the rigorous note and the honest note, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That if somebody can give it and somebody can take it, on the other side of that, there's great power. So that was that. There we were. That was 2019, I think. And now neither of us work at Lambda. I won't talk about my journey. That's not the subject of this podcast. But could you tell me your story? So we started saying on Friday the 13th, we went for a pint with Jenny Lipman, who was also not at Lambda. So how did you get from working at Lambda as part of that tradition with all of that investment to not working at Lambda?
I don't know what happened.
No.
I Yeah, I don't know if it's a... I mean, I had a big conversation with Sarah Frankham, who runs Lander now, and I'd never met her before. I mean, I might have, you know, met her briefly, spoke to her sort of once in the corridor. And we had an arranged meeting, and she was asking me all about the work and my background, and then yeah, very, very quickly sort of started saying, using words like rigidity and formality and unsafe, and I kept having to say, hang on, that's not like, where are you getting words like rigidity from? Where's, because that's the absolute opposite of what the work is. And it slightly threw me, and I ended up, you know, having to defend my work, I guess. And I, you know, you know me, Rob, I'm not one to just sort of take it. I will stand up for myself, and I'll correct people if I think that they're saying something that's inappropriate. And I, you know, and I'm sure Sarah won't mind me saying either that I stood up for myself there, and I said, no, hang on a minute, you're making sweeping judgments because you've never actually seen the work. You don't have any understanding about the work. So I'm a bit confused why you're making all these judgments and being quite, it's just a bit unnecessary, really. Come in and watch the work. And she said, yeah, I will. You know, and then asked me to do all her movement directing and all her shows. And so, yeah, great. Okay. I thought we could, you know, she'd come in and she'd see some of the work, and she might discover how it isn't rigid at all. And actually it's all about play, and it's all about improvising, and they have all that space to do that. But I don't know, somewhere along the line, there were a few meetings, and I, you know, perhaps I spoke out, and I questioned, you know, phrases like, what's the word they kept using in those meetings? Consultation. There's been lots of consultation within Lambda. And I remember in one meeting saying, I don't really know what you mean by consultation, because no one's really talked to, I don't think anyone has had conversations. Like, I really don't know what your vision is. I mean, I know it from a spreadsheet, but I don't know what you're planning to do. But I'd like to know. I'd like to be involved in it, and I'd like to know. And yeah, and then I think it, you know, we all had this. There was lots of redundancies, and there was possibility of taking voluntary redundancy. And I think I got a little feeling that the work wasn't going to stick around, and I got my voluntary redundancy in and took it and left. And the same with Johnny Baxter. He got his voluntary redundancy in. I don't think we were in, I don't know. Cause now I think probably she's got someone else there, and she's probably quite interested in the work, but maybe when the students respect the work and the class, and they're asking for it all the time, it makes you a bit of a threat. I don't know. It makes you a bit too popular. I mean, I don't consider myself popular in any way, but I think the work is popular with actors. And if you're not the sort of person who's just going to keep quiet and agree with everything and accept changes, then you can't really stay in those institutions. I can't keep quiet. I think my principles and my integrity, I mean, I curse it quite a lot of the time, because I'm sure it doesn't do me that much good in the end. But yeah, I got out, and I'm sure I wouldn't have stayed. You know, she probably wouldn't have wanted me there anyway. But yeah, it's tragic. It's tragic. And the saddest thing was that I was a bit gagged. We were all a bit gagged. I couldn't speak to the students. I couldn't really email anyone and explain. I couldn't say sorry to the students that I'd taken halfway through a journey and that were fully intending me to carry on to the end of their journey. I wasn't able to be respectful to them. And I that was really hard. That was really hard. You know, hard for me, because I've lost my teaching. And you know, Lambda invested loads of money in the book as well. They put loads of money in towards me, and this, you know, this get these books out and get donors and publishing deals and the whole lot's just sort of gone. I mean, the book hasn't, because I'm obviously it's mine and the work is with me. And Jane Gibson always said, yeah, the work isn't the institution, the work is in you. So I'm not Lambda and Lambda's not me. The work is in me, and I'll use it and take it where I want to or need to.
Yeah.
Sad. It's sad.
Yeah.
It's very sad.
Well, it's training, isn't it? It's like one can keep a career going and find places to work and hopefully find places to teach. I mean, there's something terrifying about running out of students. I always think that's the sort of the ultimate nightmare, that somehow one will end up with no one to teach. That would be just horrible. Having spent so many years trying to understand it and gathering things and honing stuff and filtering and developing. But anyway, that's fine. It's interesting what you said about part-time courses or evening classes, or maybe it's more of an America. It's more of hilariously, it's more of a Victorian model. I mean, that's what people did in the Victorian days. You know, you go and see some little lady in a flat above a shop somewhere, and you do a thing. I don't know whether it's not very satisfying, is it? I wonder if you can get as far. Maybe you can. Maybe you can do a class and get where you get to by doing a course.
You did it. You know, weekly, if you did a class weekly, like if you did one voice class weekly and one movement class weekly and an acting class weekly, I'm sure, like, over the course of, you know, 10 weeks and 10 week blocks, you're basically getting a training. I mean, I think the joy of it all being in one building is it offers its own sort of security. So I've got hammering now in the background. It offers its own community and place for a young actor to really immerse and throw themselves in it. But life isn't, I don't know. I think that's a luxury that we had. I don't know if that is going to carry on. It feels, everything's all a bit sort of, some big changes, aren't there? Big changes going on.
Mm.
Not just in drama school, but everywhere in society and globally, and I just think we have to adapt. I mean, that's the one thing that I trust, is that I the whole point of the work is that we're enabling other people to adapt, and that we have to adapt as well. I mean, why would we not? Why, of course we can adapt. And the fear is that people won't want us. Yeah, that is fearful. Very scared about that.
It's also not as much fun. I mean, I've been doing, of course, like everyone, I've been doing a bit more teaching, and I've got some lovely students I see, and sometimes I'll be this week I was in the Premier Inn in Lewisham, which is a fairly bleak experience at the best of times, but in the midst of COVID it was just sort of fucking horrendous, and I was seeing people that I really like and I enjoy teaching. So I can teach from my bedroom at the Premier Inn. But it's not as much fun as being in the staff room at Lambda and having a glass of wine at the end of the day and talking about our students and talking about the work and caring about each other's practice. And it's a hell of a lot less.
We have to just do it ourselves, you know. I mean, there's enough people. My God, I have so many conversations with people now saying they're fed up with these institutions. They're fed up with the rules and the bureaucracy that goes on in them. And I know it's so lovely hearing those things from Annie, like the sort of revolutionary side of it, and James and David as well, that it just doesn't feel possible, does it, now? I don't know, but it just has to be a quiet revolution. It has to be it's a 21st century revolution. It's not.
Okay.
It sort of seeps and it shifts, rather than it being, oh, we're all walking out of this and we're all going to set up something else. And
well, it's property price, isn't it? I mean, it's like if we could all just get a big house somewhere in the. I mean, you look at the Rose Bruford and East 15 and the New College, and that's what they used to do. They'd find some sort of slightly derelict house in Hampstead Heath, and they'd buy it and they'd do it up and they'd all move in. I mean, I'd love that. I'd do that. I'd do that tomorrow, happily. But I don't think we're not going to find that house anymore. Okay. Well, I think we should probably draw to a close. Is there anything that we didn't talk about that you'd like to? Is there anything you'd like to bear witness to? Anything that's Any itch you want to scratch or scratch you want to itch? Or
no, I don't think so. I mean, yeah, it's funny. I'm sure there's loads of things that I've missed that I think are really important to get out there and talk about and get people to understand the work. But yeah, you just have to do it. You have to do it. I mean, at the end of the day, people have to do it. You have to have the actual experience and not just hear all the words. The words are amazing. You know, it's lovely hearing people talk. And, you know, that's the other thing Jane used to say. There's loads of people that can talk about the work, but being able to teach the work is a very different thing.
So are you teaching online, Lizzie?
I am, yeah. So I'm in the building at RADA and I'm in the building at Mount View, but only temporarily because it's miles away from where I live. But I'm also doing workshops for graduates online, yeah, which I sort of set up at the beginning of the last lockdown, I think. Just contacted a couple of ex-students from Lambda and just said, oh, I might just put some sessions on to spread the word and let me know if anyone's interested. And I was flooded with emails, which was delightful. And I've been running regular workshops since then, like, you know, 8-9 months now. And yeah, they're there for just people to drop in. Like, some people don't come for a few months, some people come every single session. It's sort of cheap and cheerful. I've done some with voice practitioners. I've done a whole load on movement for screen. Yeah, it's not the same as being in a room, is it? But when actors, there's no industry. I mean, unless you can get a bit of film work, there's nothing else going on. And I think it's an opportunity for them to just stay connected to their craft and breathe and be in their body, even if it's in their sitting room.
And would you accept sort of, I'm just wondering, do you want to give a link at the end of this podcast where you say your email address or the name of the company? Do you want to do that? So, you know, somebody might listen.
Yeah, we could do. I'm halfway through setting up the website. I just can't be bothered with all that stuff, although I know it's important. I don't do Facebook. I don't do any of those things. Again, I'm probably missing a trick, but I don't care. Uh-huh. I quite like the fact that it's just growing organically. So, yeah, people just email. It's elizabethballinger@yahoo.com.
That brings us to the end of our conversation with Lizzie. The banging and the sawing got a bit loud. So you won't get to hear us say goodbye. But anyway, I'm sure you can imagine. So thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed that podcast. There'll be another one next week. I think I might interview Alan Stamford, a legendary Irish actor, about his time at the Guildhall in, I think, probably the 1960s. But I'll let you know. Thank you so much for listening. Have a good week. Bye.